He couldn't lose the picture in his mind of his father slumped on a kitchen chair, waiting for his mother. The image had always been there, but he felt he was seeing it for the first time. His father had maybe been sick down his pajamas. It was best not to breathe through your nose. "Go away," he said. But his eyes swerved so fast from Harold to the walls, it was hard to tell which he found most offensive. When they heard, neighbours consoled his father. "Joan was her own person," they said. "It's a blessing. At least you're young enough to start again." Suddenly there was an unprecedented abundance of female life in the house. Windows were thrown open, cupboards emptied, bedding aired. Casseroles, pies and jellied meat appeared, along with suet puddings, jams and fruitcake wrapped in brown paper. There had never been so much food. Mealtimes were not of particular interest to his mother. Black and white photographs disappeared into handbags, red lipsticks vanished from the bathroom, as did her bottles of scent. He saw her on street corners and crossing roads. He even caught sight of her waiting for him at school, only to dash out and discover she was a lady he didn't know, wearing one of his mother's hats or skirts. Joan always liked the bright colours. His 13th birthday came and went, with no word from her. After 6 months, Harold couldn't even smell her in the bathroom cabinet. His father began to fill the spaces that had held his wife with distant relations. "Say hello to your Auntie Muriel," he'd say. He was out of his dressing gown. Instead, he was wearing a suit that stuck out from his shoulders. He had even shaved. "Goodness, he's big!" The woman was a wide face, poking out of a fur coat, with fingers, like sausages, around a bag of macaroons. Would he like one? Harold's mouth drenched at the memory. He ate all the biscuits in his plastic bag, but they did not satisfy the craving for something that he thought was food. And he was not appeased by them. His spittle was thick and white as paste. Approaching passers-by, he hid his mouth behind his handkerchief, hoping not to cause alarm. He bought 2 pints of long-life milk and drank in gulps that spilled down his chin. He took it too fast, but the need was so intense he couldn't reason with it. He tugged again and again at the carton with his mouth. The milk wouldn't flow swiftly enough. A few feet on, he had to stop to be sick. He couldn't stop thinking of the time his mother left. In packing her suitcase, she had robbed him not only of her laughter, but also of the only person taller than himself. You could never describe Joan as affectionate, but at least she stood between her son and the clouds. The aunts passed him sweets, or went to pinch his cheek, or even asked his opinion about the fit of a dress, but the world seemed suddenly to have no edges, and he shrank from their touch. "I'm not saying he's odd," his Auntie Muriel had said. "He just doesn't look at you." Harold made it as far as Bickley, where, according to his guidebook, he should visit the small red brick castle nestling on the banks of the River Ex. However, a long-faced man in olive trousers informed him that his guidebook was sadly out of date, unless Harold was interested in a luxury wedding or a murder mystery weekend. Instead, he directed Harold to the craft and gift shop at Bickley Mill, where he might find something more to his taste and budget. He looked at the glass trinkets and lavender bags and a selection of locally carved hanging bird feeders, but none of them struck him as desirable or even necessary. This made him sad. He wanted to leave, but since he was the only person in the shop and the assistant was staring, he felt obliged to make a purchase. He came away with 4 table mats for Queenie, offering laminated views of Devon. For his wife, he chose a biro that shone a dull red when you pressed the nib, so that she could write in the dark, if she ever felt the inclination. "Harold No Mum," the boys called him at school. He began to take days off, weeks, until his classmates seemed such strangers he felt he was a different species. His Aunt Muriel wrote notes. "Harold had a headache. Harold looks pasty." Sometimes she fetched out the dictionary and got more creative. Harold had a spot of biliousness at about 6 p.m. on Tuesday. When he failed his exams, he stopped going altogether. "He's all right," said his Aunt Vera, who took Muriel's side of the bed when she left. "He's got some good jokes. He just mumbles the punchline." Weary and forlorn, Harold ordered a meal at the fisherman's cot overlooking the river. He spoke with several strangers who informed him that the bridge crossing the troubled water was the inspiration for the song by Simon and Garfunkel. And all the time he felt he was nodding and smiling and trying to look like someone who was listening, while in reality his thoughts were preoccupied with his journey, the past, and what was happening in his leg. Was it serious? Would it go away? He retired early, promising himself that sleep would heal. It didn't. "Dear son," read Joan's only letter, "New Zealand is a wonderful place. I had to go. Mothering was not me. Send my best regards to your dad." It wasn't her leaving that was the worst part. It was the fact she couldn't even spell her explanation. On Harold's 10th day, there was not an isolated moment in his walking, not one muscular flex, that did not fizz the length of his right calf and remind him he was in trouble. He remembered the urgency with which he had made his promise to the hospice nurse about walking to Queenie, and it seemed childishly inappropriate. Even his conversation with the social worker shamed him. It was as if something had happened overnight, as if the walk and his belief in it had broken into two separate pieces, and he was left only with the relentless slog. For 10 days he had walked, and all his energy had been focused into the sheer act of putting one step in front of the other. But now that he had discovered his faith in his feet, the practical anxieties had been replaced by something far more insidious. The 3.5-mile stretch along the A396 to Tiverton was his hardest yet. There were few spaces to hide from cars, and even though the hedges had been recently cut, offering silvery flashes of the River X, it gave them a barbaric appearance, and he preferred not to look. Drivers blared their horns and shouted at him to get off the road. He berated himself for managing so few miles. At this rate, it would be Christmas before he reached Berwick. A child, he told himself, could have done better. He remembered David dancing like a demon. He thought of the boy swimming out at Bantham. He saw again the occasion he had tried to tell his son a joke and how David's face had creased. "But I don't get it," he had said. He looked on the verge of tears. Harold had explained that the joke was funny. It was meant to make you laugh. He had told it a second time. "I still don't understand," the boy had said. Later, Harold heard him repeat the joke to Maureen in the bath. "He said it was funny," David had complained. "He said it twice, and it didn't make me laugh." Even at that age, he made the word sound dark. And then Harold thought of his son as an 18-year-old, his hair flowing well below his shoulders, his arms and legs too long for clothes. He saw the young man lying on his bed with his feet on the pillow, staring so hard at nothing that Harold had briefly wondered if he saw things that Harold couldn't. His wrists were bone. Harold heard himself saying, "I hear from your mother you got into Cambridge." David had not looked at him. He kept staring at the nothing. Harold had wanted to take him in his arms and hold on tight. He wanted to say, "You beautiful boy of mine, how do you get to be so clever when I am not?" But he had looked at David's impenetrable face and said, "Well, gosh, that's good. Golly." David scoffed as if he had just heard a joke that was all about his father. And Harold in turn shut the bedroom door and promised himself that one day, when his son was a full-grown man perhaps, things would be easier. From Tiverton, Harold decided to continue with the main roads. He reasoned that this route was the more direct. He would follow the Great Western Way and then cut across country lanes until he reached the A38. It should be 20 miles to Taunton. A storm was coming. Clouds drew up like a hood over the earth, and threw an eerie luminous light over the Blackdown Hills. For the first time he missed his mobile phone. He felt unprepared for what lay ahead, and he wished he could speak to Maureen. The tops of the trees shone against the granite swell of the sky, and then shook as the first winds hit them. Leaves and twigs were tossed into the air. Birds cried out. In the distance, sails of rain came into view and hung between Harold and the hills. He cowered into his jacket as the first drops hit. There was no hiding. The rain shot at Harold's waterproof jacket and down his neck, and even up the elasticated rims of his sleeves. The drops hit like peppercorns. They swirled in pools and rivulets along the gutters, and with each passing car they sloshed over the rims of his yachting shoes. After an hour his feet were water, and his skin itched from the constant chafing of wet clothes. He didn't know if he was hungry, and he couldn't remember if he had eaten. His right calf spangled with pain. A car drew up next to him and threw water the length of his trousers. It didn't matter. He could not get wetter. The passenger window steadily rolled downwards. There was a warm smell of new leather and heated air. Harold stooped his head. The face on the other side was young and dry. "Are you lost? Do you need directions?" it said. "I know where I'm going." The rain stung Harold's eyes. "But thank you for stopping." "Nobody should be out in weather like this," insisted the face. "I made a promise," said Harold, straightening up, "but I'm grateful to you for noticing me." For the next mile he asked himself whether he had been foolish not to ask for help. The longer he took to walk, the more unlikely it was that Queenie would keep living. And yet he was certain she was waiting. If he failed in his share of the bargain, albeit one without logic, he was afraid he would not see her again. "What should I do?" "Give me a sign, Queenie," he said, maybe out loud, maybe to himself. He wasn't sure any more where he officially stopped and the outside world began. A large lorry thundered towards him, blaring a violent horn, and splattered him from head to foot with mud. And yet something else happened, and it became one of those moments that he would walk into and realize, even as it was happening, that it was significant. Late in the afternoon, the rain stopped so abruptly, it was hard to credit there had been any at all. To the east, the cloud tore open, and a low belt of polished silver light broke through. Harold stood and watched as the mass of grey split again and again, revealing new colours. Blue, burnt umber, peach, green and crimson. Then the cloud became suffused with a dulled pink, as if those vibrant colours had bled through, merging as they met. He couldn't move. He wanted to witness every change. The light on the land was gold. Even his skin was warm with it. At his feet the earth creaked and whispered. The air smelt green and full of beginnings. A soft mist rose, like wisps of smoke. Harold was so tired he could barely lift his feet. And yet he felt such hope, he was giddy with it. If he kept looking at the things that were bigger than himself, he knew he would make it to Berwick. Chapter 11 Maureen and the Locum. The receptionist apologized. Due to the installation of an automated service, she was no longer able to check Maureen in for her doctor's appointment.
"But I'm standing right here," said Maureen. "Why can't you do it?"
The receptionist pointed to a screen set a few feet from the main desk and assured Maureen that the new procedure was a simple one. Maureen's fingers went clammy. The automated service asked if she was male or female, but she tapped the wrong button. It asked for her birth date, and she tapped the month before the day, and had to be helped by a young patient who sneezed all over her shoulder. By the time she had registered, there was a small queue behind her, groaning and creaking with illness. The screen flashed the words, "Refer to main reception." The small queue gave a uniform shake of its head. Again, the receptionist apologized. Maureen's regular GP had been called away unexpectedly, but she could take an appointment with a locum instead.
"Why couldn't you tell me this when I first arrived?" cried Maureen.
The receptionist offered her third round of apologies. It was the new system, she said. Everyone had to check in electronically, even OAPs. She asked if Maureen would like to wait or come back the next morning. And Maureen shook her head. If she went home, she didn't trust she would have the will to return. "Do you need a glass of water?" said the receptionist. "You look pale."
"I just need to sit a moment," said Maureen.
Of course, David had been right in reassuring her that she could leave the house, but he had no idea of the anxiety she would suffer in making her way to the surgery. It wasn't that she missed Harold, she told herself, but still it came as a fresh shock to find herself alone in the outside world. Everywhere around her people were doing ordinary things. They were driving cars and pushing buggies, and walking dogs and coming home, as if life was exactly the same, when it wasn't. It was all new and wrong. She buttoned her coat to her neck and pulled the tips of her collar against her ears. But the air felt too cold and the sky too open, shapes and colours too forceful. She had rushed down Fosbridge Road before Rex could spot her and fled to the centre of town. The petals of the daffodils along the quayside were a crumpled brown. In the waiting room, she tried to distract herself with magazines, but she looked at the words without connecting them into sentences. She was aware of couples like herself and Harold sitting side by side, keeping one another company. The late afternoon light was sprinkled with dust motes, swirling in the thick air as if it had been stirred with a spoon. When a young man opened the consulting room door and mumbled a patient's name, Maureen sat waiting for someone to get up, and wondering why they took so long, until she realized it was her own name and scrambled to her feet. The locum looked barely out of school, and his body didn't fill his dark suit. His shoes were polished like Conker's. An image came to her from nowhere of David's school shoes, and she felt a twist of anguish. She wished she had not asked for her son's help. She wished she had stayed at home.
"What can I do for you?" murmured the locum, as he folded into his chair. Words seemed to slip out of his mouth without noise, and she had to crane her head closer in order to catch them. If she wasn't careful, he'd offer her a hearing test.
Maureen explained how her husband had set off to visit a woman he had not seen for 20 years, convinced he could save her from cancer. It was his 11th day of walking, she said, rolling her handkerchief into a knot.
"He can't get to Berwick. He has no map, no proper shoes. When he left the house, he actually forgot his mobile."
Telling a stranger brought home the rawness of it, and she was afraid she would cry. She dared a glance at the locum's face. It was as if someone had stepped over to him while she wasn't looking and drawn in thick worry lines with a black pen. Maybe she had said too much. He spoke slowly, as if he were trying to remember the right words.
"Your husband thinks he's going to save his former colleague?"
"Yes."
"From cancer?"
"Yes."
She was beginning to feel impatient. She didn't want to have to explain. She wanted him instinctively to understand. She was not here to defend Harold.
"How does he think he will save her?"
"He seems to believe the walking will do it."
He scowled, creating further deep lines towards his jaw.
"He thinks a walk will cure cancer."
"A girl gave him the idea," she said. "A girl in a garage. She made him a burger as well. Harold never eats burgers at home."
"A girl told him he could cure cancer."
If this appointment continued for much longer, the boy's face would be all over the place. Maureen shook her head, trying to restore order. She was suddenly very tired.
"I am worried about Harold's health," she said.
"Is he fit and well?"
"He's slightly long-sighted without his reading glasses. He has two crowns either side of his front teeth, but it's not that which worries me."
"Yet he believes he can cure her by walking." "I don't understand. Is he a religious man?"
"Harold?"
Only time he calls on God is when the throttle goes on the lawnmower. She gave a smile to help the locum realize she was being funny. The locum looked confused. Harold retired 6 months ago. Since then, he has been very... She broke off, hunting for the word. The locum shook his head, indicating that he didn't have it. Still, she said. Still, he repeated. He spends every day in the same chair. At this, the locum's eyes lit up, and he gave a nod of relief. Ah! Depressed. He lifted his pen and snapped off the lid. I wouldn't say he was depressed. She felt her heart quickening. The thing is, Harold has Alzheimer's. There, she had said it. The locum's lips parted, and his jaw gave a disconcerting clunk. He returned the pen to his desk without reapplying the lid. He has Alzheimer's and he's walking to Berwick. Yes. What medication is your husband on, Mrs. Fry? The silence was so solemn she shivered. I say Alzheimer's, she said slowly, but it's not diagnosed as yet. The locum relaxed again. He almost laughed. Do you mean that he is forgetful? That he has senior moments? Just because we forget our mobile phone doesn't mean we all have Alzheimer's. Maureen gave a tight nod. She couldn't decide which irritated her most, the way he batted the term senior moments in her direction or the patronizing smile he was now showing her. It's in his family, she said. I recognize the signs. From here, she gave a brief account of Harold's history. How his father had returned from the war an alcoholic, prone to depression. How his parents had not wanted a child, and his mother had packed her suitcase never to return. She explained that his father had taken up with a succession of women until he showed Harold the door on his 16th birthday. After that, the two men had remained estranged for many years. Then, out of the blue, a woman rang my husband and said she was his stepmother. You'd better fetch your father, she said. He's mad as a hatter. This was the Alzheimer's. I found him a nursing home, but he was dead before he was 60. We visited several times, but his father shouted a lot and threw things. He had no idea who Harold was. And now my husband is going the same way. It isn't just forgetting things. There are other symptoms.
And does he substitute words with inappropriate ones? Forget entire conversations? Does he leave things in strange places? Suffer rapid mood swings?
Yes, yes.
She gave an impatient flick of her hand. I see, said the locum, chewing his lip. Maureen smelt victory. She watched him carefully as she said,
What I want to know is, if you, as a doctor, thought Harold was putting himself in danger by walking, could he be stopped?
Stopped.
Yes. Her throat felt stripped. Could he be forced to return home?
The blood beat so hard through her head it hurt.
He can't walk 500 miles. He can't save Queenie Hennessy. He must be made to come back.
Maureen's words rang through the silence. She placed her hands on her knees, palm against palm, and then she tidied her 2 feet, one beside the other. She had said what she had set out to say, but she wasn't feeling what she had set out to feel, and needed to impose physical order on an uncomfortable emotion that was swelling inside her. The locum grew still. From outside she heard a child crying, and wished to goodness someone would pick it up. He said, It sounds as if we have a strong case for getting the police involved. Has your husband ever been sectioned? Maureen rushed from the doctor's surgery, sick with shame. In explaining both Harold's past and his walk, she had been forced to see things for the first time from his point of view. The idea was insane and completely out of character, but it wasn't Alzheimer's. There was even a beauty in it, if only because Harold was doing something he believed in for once and against all the odds.
She had told the locum she needed time to think and that she was worrying over nothing. Harold was just a little senior. He would be home soon. He might even be there already. She had ended up with a prescription for low-dosage sleeping tablets for herself. As she walked towards the quay, the truth came as bright as a light snapping on through the dark. The reason she had stayed with Harold all these years was not David. It wasn't even because she felt sorry for her husband. She had stayed because, however lonely she was with Harold, the world without him would be even more desolate. Maureen bought a single pork chop and a yellowing bunch of broccoli at the supermarket. "Is that all?" said the girl at the checkout. Maureen couldn't speak. She turned into Fosbridge Road and thought of the silence of the house that lay waiting for her. The unpaid household bills in their neat but no less intimidating pile. Her body grew heavy, her feet slow. Rex was trimming the hedge with clippers as she reached the garden gate.
"How's the patient?" he said. "Getting better?"
She nodded her head and went inside. Chapter 12. Harold and the Cycling Mothers. Strangely, it was Mr. Napier who had teamed Harold and Queenie together all those years ago. He had summoned Harold to his wood-panelled office and told him he required Queenie to check the pub's account books on site. He didn't trust the landlords and wanted to take them unawares. Since the lady didn't drive, however, someone was required to take her. He had thought carefully about the matter, he said, tugging on a cigarette. As one of the more senior reps and also one of the few married ones, Harold was the obvious candidate. Mr. Napier stood with his legs wide, as if by claiming more floor space he became bigger than everyone else, although actually he was a wily figure in a shiny suit who barely reached Harold's shoulder. Harold had no choice, of course, but to agree. Privately, he was anxious. He had not spoken to Queenie since the embarrassing episode in the cupboard. And besides, he had seen his time in the car as his own. He didn't know if she would like Radio 2, for instance. He hoped she wouldn't want to talk. It was bad enough with the chaps. He was uncomfortable with female things. "Glad that's sorted," said Mr. Napier. He held out his hand. It was disconcertingly slight and moist, like taking hold of a small reptile. "How's the wife?" Harold faltered. "She's well. How's—" He felt a cold panic. Mr. Napier was on his third wife in 6 years, a young woman with high blonde hair who had worked briefly as a barmaid. He didn't take it kindly when people forgot her name. "Veronica is splendid. I hear your boy got into Cambridge." Mr. Napier broke into a grin. His chain of thought shifted on a sixpence. Harold never knew what was coming next. "All brain and no dick," he said, spitting out a shot of smoke from the side of his mouth. He stood, watching and laughing, waiting for his employee to come back at him, and knowing that he wouldn't. Harold lowered his head. On the desk stood Mr. Napier's prized collection of Murano glass clowns, some with blue faces, some lounging on their backs, others playing instruments. "Don't touch," said Mr. Napier, and his forefinger shot out like a gun. "They were my mother's." Everyone knew they were his prized possessions, but to Harold the figures looked misshapen and lurid, as if their limbs and faces had contorted like slime in the sun, and the colours congealed. He couldn't help feeling they were mocking him, even these glass clowns, and felt a wave of anger lick deep in his belly. Mr. Napier twisted his cigarette in the ashtray and moved to the door. As Harold passed, he added, "And keep an eye on Hennessy, will you? You know what those bitches are like." He tapped his nose with that forefinger, as if it was now the pointer to a shared secret and not a gun. Except, of course, Harold had no idea what he was talking about. He wondered if, despite her aptitude, Mr. Napier was already trying to get rid of her. His boss never trusted the people who were better than himself. The first drive came a few days later. Queenie appeared at his car, gripping her square handbag, as if she was off on a shopping trip instead of an inspection of a pub's account books. Harold knew the landlord of the pub. He was a slippery chap at the best of times. He couldn't help feeling afraid for her.
"I hear you're driving me, Mr. Fry," she said, slightly imperious.
They travelled in silence. She sat beside him, very neat, her hands tucked in a tight ball in her lap. Harold had never felt so conscious of how he took the corners, or pressed his foot into the clutch, or pulled at the handbrake when they arrived. He leapt out to open the passenger door, and waited as her legs slowly emerged and groped for the pavement. Maureen's ankles were so slim they made him weak with desire. Queenie's, on the other hand, were thick. Rather like himself, he had felt, she lacked physical definition. When he glanced up, he was mortified to find her staring straight back at him.
"Thank you, Mr. Fry," she said at last, clipping away, with the handbag wedged on her arm.
It therefore came as a surprise, when he was checking the beer levels, to find the landlord beetroot-faced and dripping sweat.
"Fuck me," he said. "That little woman's a demon. You can't get a thing past her."
Harold felt a small rush of admiration, touched with pride. On the journey back, she was silent and still again. He even wondered if she was asleep, but it seemed rude to look in case she wasn't. He pulled into the yard at the brewery, and she said suddenly, "Thank you." He muttered something awkward about it being a pleasure.
"I mean, thank you for a few weeks ago," she said, "the time in the stationery cupboard."
"Don't mention it," said Harold, meaning exactly that.
"I was very upset.
You were kind to me. I should have said thank you before, but I was embarrassed. That was wrong." He couldn't meet her eye. He knew, without looking at her, that she was biting her lip.
"I was glad to help."
He reapplied the poppers on his driving gloves.
"You're a gentle man," she said, spreading the word into two halves, so that for the first time he saw it for what it meant, a gentle man.
With that, she opened her door before he could do it for her and stepped out of his car. He watched her pick her way across the yard, steady and neat, in her brown suit, and it broke his heart. The honest plainness of her. He had got into bed that night and silently promised that whatever Mr. Napier had meant by his obscure remark, Harold would be true to it. He would look out for Queenie. Maureen's voice had sailed through the dark.
"I hope you're not going to snore."
On the 12th day, an endless bed of grey moved over the sky and land, bringing sheets of rain that smudged the colour and contours out of everything. Harold stared ahead, straining to find a sense of direction, or the break in the cloud that had so delighted him. But it was like looking at the world through net curtains again. Everything was the same. He stopped referring to his guidebooks because the gap between their sense of knowing and his own of not knowing was too unbearable. He felt he was fighting his body and failing. His clothes no longer dried. The leather of his shoes was so bloated with water they lost their shape. Whitnage, Westley, Whitehall. So many places beginning with W. Trees, hedgerows, telegraph poles, houses, recycling bins. He left his razor and shaving foam in the shared bathroom of a guest house and lacked the energy to replace them. Inspecting his feet, he was alarmed to discover that the burning in his calf had taken physical shape and was a violent stain of crimson beneath the surface of the skin. For the first time, he was very frightened. In Samford, Arundel, Harold phoned Maureen. He needed to hear her voice, and he wanted her to remind him why he was walking, even if she did it in anger. He didn't want her to suspect the doubt he was suffering, or the difficulty with his leg, so he asked her how she was and also the house, and she told him they were both well. She in turn asked if he was still walking, and he said that he had passed Exeter and Tiverton and was on his way to Bath, via Taunton. Was there anything he wanted sending on? His mobile, his toothbrush, his pyjamas or spare clothes? There was a kindness in her voice, but he was surely imagining it.
"I'm all right," he said.
"So you must almost be in Somerset."
"I'm not sure. I suppose I must."
How many miles today?
I don't know, maybe 7. Well, well, she said. The rain beat the roof of the phone box, and the dim light beyond the windows was like something fluid. He wanted to stay, talking to Maureen, but the silence and the distance, which they had nursed for 20 years, had grown to such a point that even clichés were empty, and they hurt. At last she said, "Well, I must get going, Harold. Lots to do."
"Yes, me too. I just wanted to say hello and everything, check you were all right."
"Oh, I'm very well, very busy. The days whiz by. I hardly notice you've gone. And you?"
"I'm very well, too."
"Well, that's all right, then."
"Yes."
Eventually, there was nothing left. He only said, "Well, goodbye, Maureen," because it was a sentence. He didn't want to hang up any more than he wanted to walk. He looked out at the rain, waiting for it to break, and saw a crow with its head bowed, its feathers so wet they shone like tar. He wished the bird would move, but it sat sodden and alone. Maureen was so busy she had hardly noticed Harold had gone. On Sunday it was almost lunchtime when he woke. The pain in his leg was no better, and the rain was still falling. He could hear the world outside going about its business, the traffic, the people, all rushing to other things. No one knew who or where he was. He lay not moving, not wanting to face another day's walking, and yet knowing he couldn't go home. He remembered how Maureen used to lie at his side, and he pictured her nakedness. How perfect it was, and how small. He yearned for the softness of her fingers as they crept their passage over his skin. When Harold reached for his yachting shoes, they were paper-thin at the soles. He didn't shower or shave or inspect his feet, although putting them into his shoes felt like cramming them into cases. He dressed without thinking of anything, because thinking would only lead to the obvious. The landlady insisted he could have a late breakfast, but he declined. If he accepted her kindness, if he so much as caught her eye, he was afraid he would cry. Harold kept going from Samford Arundel, but hated every step. He screwed his face against the pain. It didn't matter what people thought. He was outside them anyway. He wouldn't stop, though his body cried out for rest. He was angry with himself for being so frail. The rain drove at him in slants. His shoes were so spent he might as well not be wearing them. He missed Maureen and could think of nothing else. How was it that things had gone so wrong? They had been happy once. If David had caused a rift between them as he grew, it had been a complicit one.
"Where's David?"
Maureen might ask, and Harold would simply reply that he had heard the front door shutting as he cleaned his teeth. "Ah, yes," she would say, to show it wasn't a problem that their 18-year-old son had taken to wandering the streets at night. To voice Harold's private fears would only compound hers. And the fact was, she still cooked in those days. She still shared Harold's bed. But such unspoken tensions could not hide themselves forever. It was just before Queenie's disappearance that things had finally ripped open and splintered apart. Maureen had railed. She had sobbed. She had beat his chest with her fists. "Call yourself a man," she had howled. And another time, "It's your fault, all this. It would have been fine if it hadn't been for you." It had been unbearable to hear those things. And even though she had wept in his arms afterwards and apologized, they were in the air when he was alone, and there was no unsaying them. It all came from Harold. And then it had stopped, the talking, the shouting, the catching his eye. This new silence was different from before. Whereas once they had wished to spare one another pain, now there was nothing left to salvage. She didn't even have to give voice to the words in her head. He knew simply by looking at her that there was not a word, not a gesture, he could say or do to make amends. She no longer blamed Harold. She no longer cried in front of him. She wouldn't allow him the comfort of holding her. She moved her clothes into the spare room, and he lay in their marital bed, not going to her because she didn't want him, but tortured by her sobs. Morning would come. They would use the bathroom at different times. He would dress and eat breakfast while she paced from room to room, as if he was not there, as if never keeping still was the only way to contain a person's feelings.
I'm off.
Okay, then.
See you later.
Yes, okay.
The words meant nothing. They might as well have been Chinese. There was no bridging the gap that lies between two human beings. Just before his retirement, he had suggested they might for once go to the brewery Christmas party, and she had stared back at him with her mouth gaping, as if he was guilty of assault. Harold stopped looking at the hills, the sky, and the trees. He stopped looking for the road signs that would mark his journey north. He walked against the wind, with his head bowed, seeing only rain, because that was all there was. The A-38 was far worse than he had imagined. He stuck to the hard shoulder and walked behind the barrier when he could, but traffic tore past at such speed he was drenched and constantly in danger. After several hours, he realized he had been so lost in remembering and mourning the past, he had wasted 2 miles heading in the wrong direction. There was nothing for it but to retrace his steps. Walking the road already traveled was even harder. It was like not moving at all. It was worse, like eating into a part of himself. West of Bagley Green, he gave up and stopped at a farmhouse advertising accommodation. His host was a worried-looking man who said he had one available room. The others were occupied by 6 female cyclists on the trail from Land's End to John O'Groats. "They're all mothers," he said. "You get the impression they're letting their hair down." He warned Harold it might be better to keep a low profile. Harold slept poorly. He was dreaming again, and the mother cyclist seemed to be having a party. Harold slipped between sleep and consciousness, afraid of the pain in his leg, but desperate to forget it. The women's voices became those of the aunts who had replaced his mother. There was laughter, and a grunt as his father emptied himself. Harold lay with his eyes wide and his leg throbbing, wishing the night was over and he was somewhere else. In the morning the pain had worsened. The skin above his heel was streaked with purple, and so swollen it would barely fit inside the shoe. He had to ram it home, wincing at the pain. He caught his face in the mirror, and it was haggard and burnt, covered in sharp stubble like pinheads. He looked ill. All he could picture was his father in the nursing home, with his slippers on the wrong feet.
"Say hello to your son,"
the carer had said. Catching sight of Harold, his father had begun to shake. Harold hoped to finish his breakfast before the cycling mothers awoke, but just as he was draining his coffee, they descended on the farmhouse dining room in a burst of fluorescent lycra and laughter.
"You know what?" said one. "I don't know how I'm going to get on that bike again."
The others laughed. Of the 6 women, she was the loudest and gave the impression of being the ringleader. Harold hoped that by remaining quiet he would go unnoticed. But she caught his eye and winked.
"I hope we didn't disturb you," she said.
She was dark-skinned with a skeletal face and hair cropped so close her scalp looked fragile. He couldn't help wishing she had a hat. These girls were her life support, she told Harold. She didn't know where she'd be without them. She lived in a small flat with her daughter.
"I'm not the settling kind," she said. "I don't need a man."
She named all the things she could do without one. It seemed to Harold there were an awful lot. Though she spoke at such speed, he had to concentrate on her mouth in order to understand. It took effort to keep watching and listening and taking her in, when within himself there was such pain.
"I'm free as a bird," she said.
And she stuck out her arms to show what she meant. Puffs of dark hair sprouted from her armpits. There was a round of wolf whistles and cries of, "Go, girl!" Harold felt the need to join in, but could only go as far as a light clapping of his hands. The woman laughed and smacked her palm against theirs, although there was something febrile about her independence that made him nervous on her behalf.
"I sleep with who I want. I had my daughter's piano teacher last week. I had a Buddhist on my yoga retreat, and he was sworn to celibacy."
Several of the mothers whooped. The only woman with whom Harold had slept was Maureen. Even when she threw away her cookery books and had her hair cut short, even when he heard her door lock click at night, he had not looked for anyone else. He knew other chaps at the brewery had affairs. There had once been a bar lady who laughed at his jokes, even the poor ones, and nudged a glass of whiskey across the bar so that their hands almost touched. But he hadn't the stomach for more. He could never imagine himself with anyone other than Maureen. They had shared so much. To live without her would be like scooping out the vital parts of himself. And he would be no more than a fragile envelope of skin. He found himself congratulating the cycling mother, because he wasn't sure what else to do, and then he stood to make his excuses. A flash shot up his leg so that he stumbled and had to reach for the table. He pretended to be scratching his arm while it came and went, and came again.
"Bon voyage,"
said the cycling mother. She rose to embrace him, bringing a thick smell of citrus and sweat that was half pleasant and half not so. She laughed as she pulled back and rested her arms on his shoulders.
"Free as a bird," she told him,
her face very full of it. He felt a chill in his heart. Glancing beyond himself, he saw that her inner arm was lacerated with two deep scars that scissored the flesh between her wrist and elbow. In places, one still wore the beads of a scab. He nodded stiffly and wished her luck. Harold couldn't go for more than 15 minutes without needing to stop and rest his right leg. His back, neck, arms and shoulders were so sore he thought of little else. The rain drove at him in thick pins that bounced off the roofs and tarmac. After only an hour, he was stumbling and desperate to stop. There were trees ahead and something red that was maybe a flag. People left the strangest things at the roadside. The rain plashed on the leaves, making them shiver, and the air smelt of the soft leaf mould at his feet. As Harold grew closer to the flag, his shoulders hunched. The splash of red was not a flag. It was a Liverpool FC T-shirt, hanging from a wooden cross. He had passed several roadside memorials, but none of them disturbed him so much as this one. He told himself to walk on the other side and not look, but he couldn't. He was drawn to it, like something he shouldn't see. Evidently a relative or friend had decorated the cross with glittery Christmas baubles in the shape of pine trees and a plastic wreath of holly. Harold examined the wilting flowers in cellophane, lead of colour, and the photograph in a plastic wallet. The man was maybe in his 40s, thick-set, with dark hair, and had a child's hand trailing his shoulder. He was grinning at the camera. "To the best dad in the world," read the words on a sodden card. What eulogy would you write for the worst one? "Fuck you," David had hissed as his legs failed him, and he seemed to be in danger of catapulting down the stairs. "Fuck you." Harold wiped the rain from the photograph with a clean corner of his handkerchief and flicked it from the flowers. As he walked on, all he could think of was the cycling mother. He wondered when it was that she had felt so desolate she had cut her arm and left it to bleed. He wondered who had found her and what they had done. Had she wanted to be saved, or had they dragged her back to life just as she believed she was free of it? He wished he could have said something to make her never do it again. If he had comforted her, he could have let her go. As it was, he knew that in meeting her and listening, he was carrying another weight in his heart, and he wasn't sure how much more of that he could take. Despite the pain in his calf and the cold in his bones, despite the trouble in his mind, he drove himself harder. Harold reached the outskirts of Taunton by late afternoon. The houses were packed together and studded with satellite dishes. At the windows hung grey net drapes. Some were boarded with metal shutters. The few gardens that were not concrete had been flattened by rain. The blossom of a cherry tree lay scattered like wet paper across the pavement. The traffic sped past so loud it hurt, and the roads looked oiled. A memory surged into his mind, one of those that Harold most feared. He was normally so good at repressing them. He tried to think about Queenie, but even that wouldn't work. He shot his elbows out sideways to go faster and drove his feet against the paving stones with such fury he hadn't the breathing to keep up. But nothing would hide him from the memory of an afternoon 20 years ago when it had all come to an end. He could see his hand reaching for the wooden door, feel the warmth of the sun on his shoulders, smell the mouldering, heated-up air, hear the stillness of a silence that was not what it should be.
No!
He shouted, batting out at the rain. Suddenly his calf exploded, as if the skin side of the muscle had been sliced open. The ground tipped at an angle and seemed to swell. He reached out a hand to stop it, but in the same moment his knees buckled and his body lurched to the ground. He felt his hands and knees smart.
Forgive me. Forgive me for letting you down.
The next thing he knew, someone was tugging at his arms and shouting about an ambulance. Chapter 13 Harold and the Doctor. Harold's collapse caused cuts to his knees and hands and bruising on both elbows. The woman who rescued him had spotted his fall from her bathroom window. She helped Harold to his feet and retrieved the contents of his plastic bag, and then she supported him across the road, waving at traffic.
"Doctor! Doctor!" she shouted.
Inside her house, she led him to an easy chair and loosened his tie. The room seemed sparse and cold. A television had been angled on top of a packing box. Close by, a dog was barking behind a closed door. Harold had never been comfortable with dogs.
"Did I break anything?" he said.
She said words he couldn't understand.
"There was a pot of honey," he said, more panicky. "Is it still in one piece?"
The woman nodded and reached for his pulse. She covered his wrist with her fingertips and stared into the middle distance, as if seeing shapes beyond the walls, while she counted under her breath. She was young, but her face had a scraped-back look, and her jogging trousers and sweatshirt hung from her body, suggesting they belonged to someone else. A man, perhaps.
"I don't need a doctor," Harold said with a hoarse whisper. "Please don't call an ambulance or a doctor."
Harold didn't want to be in her house. He didn't want to take up her time or get close to another stranger, and he was afraid she would send him home. He wanted to speak to Maureen, but he was also afraid he wouldn't know what to say without troubling her. He wished he hadn't given in to his fall. It had been in him to keep going. The young woman passed a mug of tea, offering the handle so that he wouldn't burn his fingers. She was saying something else, but he couldn't make it out. He tried to smile, as if he understood, but she kept looking at him, waiting for his reply. And then she said it again, with more volume and less speed.
"What the fuck were you doing out there in the rain?"
He realized now that she had a thick accent, Eastern European, maybe. He and Maureen read about people like her in the news. They came over for the benefits, the papers said. Meanwhile, the dog was increasingly sounding not like a dog and more like a wild beast. It was hurling its full body weight against its temporary imprisonment and sounded in danger of biting at least one of them when free. You read about dogs like that in the papers as well. Harold reassured her that as soon as he had finished his tea, he would get going. He told his story, which she heard in silence. This was why he couldn't stop or see a doctor. He had made a promise to Queenie, and he must not fail her. He took a sip from his mug and looked at the window. A large tree trunk stood right in front of it. Its roots were probably damaging the house, and it needed cutting back. Beyond, the traffic came at fast intervals. The thought of returning outside filled him with dread, and yet he had no choice. But when he looked back to the young woman, she was still watching him, and still not smiling.
"But you're fucked,"
she said without emotion or judgment. "Ah, yes," said Harold.
"Your shoes are fucked. So is your body and your spectacles."
She held up the two halves of his reading glasses, one in each hand.
"Every way you look at it, you're fucked. How do you think you're going to make it to Berwick?"
It reminded him of the very deliberate way in which David swore, as if he had carefully considered all the options, and given what he felt for his father, the foulest expressions were the only ones suitable.
"I am, as you rightly point out, fucked."
Harold hung his head. His trousers were splattered with mud and frayed at the knees. His shoes were sodden. He wished he had taken them off at the door.
"I admit it is an awfully long way to Berwick. I admit I am wearing the wrong clothes, and I also admit I have not the training or the physique for my walk. I can't explain why I think I can get there, when all the odds are against it, but I do. Even when a big part of me is saying I should give up, I can't. Even when I don't want to keep going, I still do it."
He faltered because what he was saying was difficult and caused him anguish.
"I am terribly sorry. But my shoes appear to have wet your carpet."
To his surprise, when he stole a glance at the young woman, she was smiling for the first time. She offered him a room for the night. At the bottom of the stairs, she kicked the door that housed the angry dog with the underside of her foot and told Harold to follow. He was afraid of the dog, and he didn't want her to worry about the amount of pain he was in, so he tried to keep up with her. The truth was that his knees and palms felt spiked after his fall, and he couldn't put any weight on his right leg. The woman told him that her name was Martina. She was from Slovakia. He would have to excuse this shithole, she said, and also the noise.
"We thought this fucking place was temporary."
Harold tried to make his face look like that of someone who was used to her sort of language. He didn't want to appear judgmental.
"I curse too much," she said, as if reading his thoughts.
"It's your house, Martina. You must say what you like."
The dog was still barking and clawing the paintwork behind the door below.
"Shut the fuck up!" she yelled.
Harold could see the fillings at the back of her teeth. "My son always wanted a dog," he said. "It's not mine, it's my partner's." She threw open the door of an upstairs room and stood aside to let him enter. The room smelled of emptiness and new paint. The walls were a stark white, with a purple bedspread that matched the curtains, and three sequined cushions over the pillows. It touched Harold that Martina, for all her bitterness, had taken such care over her soft furnishings. At the window, the upper branches and leaves of the tree crushed themselves against the glass. She said she hoped Harold would be comfortable, and he assured her that he would. Left alone, he eased his body onto the bed and felt every muscle throbbing. He knew he should examine the cuts and wash them, but he hadn't the will to move. He hadn't even the will to remove the shoes from his feet. He didn't know how he was going to carry on like this. He was frightened, and he felt alone. It reminded him of his teens, of hiding in his room while his father crashed into bottles or made love to the aunts. He wished he hadn't accepted Martina's offer to stay the night. Maybe she was already phoning a doctor. He could hear her voice downstairs, although listening hard he didn't recognize any of the words. Maybe it was her partner. Maybe her partner would insist on driving Harold home. He pulled Queenie's letter from his pocket, but without his reading glasses the words spilled into one another. "Dear Harold, this may come to you as some surprise. I know it is a long time since we last met, but recently I have been thinking about the past. Last year I had an operation on a tumour, but the cancer has spread,
and there is nothing left to be done. I am at peace and comfortable, but I would like to